Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Panning the Stream. I am your host. I am Dan Reichert. I am sitting across the table from my lovely wife, Bianca Reichert. How are you doing, honey?
I'm great. How are you, Dan?
Doing great. Let's talk about a murder trial.
Let's do it.
All right. So that is what we watched this time was The Staircase on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Originally an 8-part miniseries on some French TV station and then scooped up and bought by Netflix.
Is that really what happened?
I think it was a French thing. A 2-hour version of it aired on like some Dateline type thing here in the States at some point. And then I think the French filmmakers made like 2 sequel movie special type things. And then that's when Netflix bought it up and consolidated it all into the 13 episodes known as The Staircase on Netflix.
And why is it called The Staircase?
Well, we are going to get to that here because that's what old Michael Peterson, a fella that people thought he pushed his wife down a flight of stairs. Wait, no. No. It was coincidentally at the bottom of stairs. Maybe she fell. Maybe he beat her to death. Maybe it happened to 2 women he was close to.
Mm.
We are going to cover all these details here. Well, not all the details from the entire 13 episodes, because it's a very long runtime.
And unlike a lot of these crime documentaries, this focused less on the actual case and more about like the criminal justice process. It was very, like, in the weeds in the trial and everything. And, I mean, like, also, like a lot of these documentaries, it was very clearly kind of biased in favor of the defense.
Yes. We see things. Well, obviously, okay, so the filmmakers here have all the access in the world to Michael Peterson, the defendant,
mm-hmm.
and his lawyer, David Rudolph, and the family. Like, we see a whole lot of Michael Peterson at home with his family during this whole process. So it tries to humanize him in a way. And I would argue at times very successfully.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe plants the seed of doubt in the viewer's mind. Because at the beginning here, which we're going to go over all the details of the case and everything. But at the beginning, I heard what happened. I saw the pictures. And it's like, well, obviously he fucking did it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the course of it, things happen and interviews and new evidence comes to light that successfully made me kind of wonder.
Question.
Which we will we'll kind of cover where we were on our thoughts on Michael Peterson's guilt as this progresses. So first, I just kind of want to hit the main beats here of what happened, and then what the prosecution says happened, what the defense says happened, and then we will go over some of the motives and evidence and our own feelings.
Let's
here.
Let's do it.
All right, so Michael Peterson, he is a author of Vietnam War books mm-hmm. primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And him and his wife, Kathleen Peterson, are very successful.
She's very successful.
Well, so was he not a successful author? Because I got the sense that was part of the reason that there was this media circus and everything is because he was a fairly successful author. Not like, this isn't J.K. Rowling or some huge, that's the one big author I guess I can name. That's the Harry Potter lady. But yeah, I got the sense that he made a living doing this.
No, I got the impression that he was an author. And he wrote for the paper. Like, he wasn't a huge author, but he was known in the community because he wrote for the paper. And his wife, Kathleen, was a successful business executive. I don't think he was successful enough to sustain himself or anything like that. I mean, I think she was definitely the breadwinner.
Okay, so we see this big house and this kind of a beautiful house and area and everything. So that, I guess, came from her executive stuff at some corporation or some
mm-hmm.
business thing. We're experts here at Panning the Stream.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is December 2001, okay, so this is Michael's story. Michael's story is that him and Kathleen were enjoying some wine next to their pool, and she decides to go to bed. She goes inside, and then when he goes into the house, he finds her at the bottom of a staircase, blood everywhere, and he calls the cops. And early on in this documentary, we hear the phone call, a very frantic Michael who's saying that she is still breathing. That's something that comes up for sure. So according to him, he walked in. He didn't hear her screaming or anything. They do mm-hmm. some tests like, oh, would you even be able to hear over the, you know, mm-hmm. the water and the outside and everything? And so that's his story. That's the defense's whole story, is that she fell down the stairs, most likely, you know, had a couple drinks. I can't remember if they said that she had some, like, Valium or something in her.
Well, yeah, she wasn't saying, the defense wasn't, like, blatantly saying, like, oh, this was a fall, but they were saying, like, there's definitely evidence that suggests it could have been a fall. But also, I will say, too, that Michael Peterson's story did change a lot as it went on. Like, because he did say originally, like, oh, we were out by the pool, and then she went inside, and I stayed out by the pool, and then when I came back. But other times, he says, you know, I went outside, I heard her, and then I came right back in. But, I mean, we'll get into the weeds with it, but, like, there's just evidence that isn't really consistent with the story that he told.
Yeah, and if he said it was a while after he came in there, why was she still breathing? And why did the cops say that, like, the blood was dry when they got there?
And if the other story he was telling was true, which is that he immediately found her after she fell, the autopsies showed that it was a long death, that she bled out for a while. So why did he wait to call the police in that case?
Yeah, it does not look good for Michael Peterson, especially the beginning of this documentary, because you see the pictures of her head and you see the blood in the staircase, and it is brutal.
It's really brutal.
There is blood all over, like, all the walls and everything, and you see the autopsy photos of the back of her head, and there are, like, I think seven huge lacerations, just deep lacerations. And so that is the prosecution's main story, is that they think it is a blow poke, a little thing that you use to poke logs in a fireplace. That, what was the deal? It was, like, heavy enough to cause the lacerations, but not heavy enough to cause skull damage, because they did not find skull damage.
A blow poke or something like that.
Yeah, which they do very specifically hone in on one specific thing. We find out a little later on. But yes, they are saying he beat her to death in this staircase with this blow poke. That's why you have the lacerations there, no brain damage, things like that. So, the key players here, obviously, you got Michael, you got Kathleen, you got David Rudolph, who is Michael's attorney, who we spend a ton of time with. It seems to be a tremendous attorney.
Yes.
I think I told you several times while we were watching, like, hey, if some bullshit ever happens and I'm ever falsely accused of anything, please get David Rudolph on my case, because he just seems to be extremely good at his job.
Yeah, that David Rudolph is really something.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem overly, like, sleazy or anything. Like, you know, there are a lot of, like, lawyers that are really good at, like, getting their clients off, but, like, they seem kind of sleazy or whatever. Like, he just seems like he really cares and really believed in Michael's innocence and really, he doesn't seem cheap.
But worth it. I mean, if you're an innocent person and you have, you know, the money to spend on a lawyer, that seems like a great investment, because if you have to pay $1 million, that's your life. You know what I mean? It seems worth it.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy to me, because I have not, you may know this about me, Bianca, I tend to sometimes just see things and think, and not think super deeply about it. You know,
oh,
I just kind of, but then upon, like, examination and I think deeper, I realize things, I'm not incapable of it. I think I just take a lot of things, like, at surface value and don't really think deeper about it.
Or you make wild assumptions.
Like what?
Like, all right, just one off the top of my head is the sweatshirt thing.
Well, no, that's the thing. That's the thing, is that it's not, that was not, okay, what she's referring to is her saying something about my hoodie smelling. She calls them sweatshirts, they're hoodies. And her being like, have you ever washed this? And it's not like I walked around my whole life with the assumption that you can't wash a hoodie.
Okay.
It's just in the moment when I was trying to think of why I never thought to wash one, I thought, like, oh, I guess my thought process was that it's not touching my skin, so it's not smelly.
All right, what about with Lucian? We were playing with Lucian, my parents' dog, and he's fixed, and Lucian was laying on his back where you could see his tiny little pecker, and Dan was like, oh, I thought he was fixed. Because you thought fixed means getting the penis removed.
Okay, that is something I did actively think my entire life was, because I remember in, like, Mad Magazine or whatever, you would see cartoons of, like, dogs running away from the vet, and the vet has, like, a giant cartoon scissors.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, oh, I guess neutering is just cutting off their dicks.
No.
Okay, well, I learned that, like, a year or two ago.
Oh,
so,
Lord.
Anyway, the realizations I had during this were, I'd always heard things about how, like, oh, if you're rich, you can, you know, you can get away with murder or whatever. You know, you get good lawyers, you can afford good lawyers, and they'll get you off. Like, and obviously, like, you know, I followed, like, the OJ case, and we watched a documentary on that, and
the
obviously
Jakes that,
Robert Durst and everything. Like, and there's no denying that these guys, you know, the Johnny Cochran and Durst lawyer and everything, like, they know exactly what they're doing, and they're extremely good at it. But I guess I've never actually thought about why the money thing helps. I guess maybe I just thought, I don't know. I never thought actively about it until I watched this, and you are actively seeing, how much money this must cost. You've got this team of lawyers, and we'll get to why, but they do fly out to Germany. They're looking into all this stuff. They're going
they
to great expense.
Tests.
Oh, they've got focus tests for like, oh, how would jurors testing. Respond to, you know, this testimony from the blood spatter analysis?
I would imagine that, and maybe this is a wild assumption on my part, but to become a lawyer, you have to have a certain level of intellect.
Yeah.
So even court-appointed lawyers, you know, the ones that the defendant would get for free, are probably reasonably intelligent and able to do a great job. But, like, David Rudolph, he's able to see, like, every possible outcome. Like, every he's able to refute every piece of evidence that the prosecution presents. It's just he sees the entire matrix. And, like, and granted what you were saying about the money, I mean, like, he's able to be like, look, if we get this focus group, it'll be about, like, $35,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
And they could just fucking do that because, like, they have the money to do it.
And that's the thing is, like, the lengths they were going to, I did have that realization while watching this where it's like, oh, I bet if this was some court-appointed thing, I bet they don't do, you know, I bet they do their best to, you know, gather evidence and stuff like that. But I doubt they're bringing in, like, all these experts and focus groups and flying whole teams out to Germany. Like, they flew the family out there and all this stuff. Like, it really kind of woke me up to that. Like, I'm so ignorant to the way the court process works that, like, I think until I watched this, I never knew why you would always see, like, on the paper, like, oh, the state of North Carolina versus whatever. Like, I didn't realize that the prosecution worked for, like, the government. Like, and I guess I never really knew where the prosecution came from. You know, like, I would watch the OJ thing and I'd see Marcia Clark and Chris Darden and everything. And I guess I never really thought, like, oh, yeah, they work. Like, I never knew what, like, a district attorney was. And then I put it together here. It's like, oh, they work for the state and they're always trying to prosecute.
They're trying to bring people to justice. But, and then when you see, like, civil trials, in that case, it would be like Kathleen Peterson's family versus Michael Peterson, because then they're just going for money. It's not like a criminal trial.
Oh, and that would be like a hired lawyer against a hired lawyer, right? Not like the state?
I think, yeah. I think that would be the case. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
So like in the OJ thing, it was probably like the Goldman family's lawyer against, you know, the OJ's guys or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And in those cases, it doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I find this stuff fascinating, and I love watching all these true crime documentaries with you. But, like, yeah, the more I watch, and especially with this one, I just kind of realize, like, oh, I have no idea how the court system works at all.
Oh, neither do I. I mean, I'm sure, like, a lot of stuff I'm saying right now is wrong, and any lawyer who's listening to this is probably like, ugh.
Well, that's our main demographic.
Shout out to Michael Cantor, who's probably listening to this and grating his teeth.
That's our top demographic is lawyers.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's really eye-opening and just – you know, you could see why, like, going into this, our initial idea of what the case was, oh, this guy's definitely guilty. But then as time goes on, you see Rudolph and, you know, the defense team, like, plant these seeds of doubt.
Yeah.
And because the way it works is, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, then you're guilty. If there's any question of his innocence, then they would be not guilty, right?
Yeah, Cochran was able to take the glove thing and plant the seed of doubt there.
Yeah, I mean, it's because they did such a good job of that. That alone, like, I think Peterson is totally guilty, but if I was on that jury, I probably would have voted not guilty because they did present, like, some possibilities, you know, some alternative ideas of what happened.
We'll get to a lot of the specific ones, but yeah, by the end, David Rudolph in his closing arguments does present, like, okay, one thing of reasonable doubt should be enough to get him off this, and he presents, like, a PowerPoint thing of, like, 10, you know, solid reasonable doubt arguments here, regardless of whether you're sold on him being guilty or not.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the strongest pieces that the defense has was Dr. Henry Lee.
Yes.
Who is, like, one of the most foremost forensic scientists in his field, like, doing the blood spatter analysts and all that. Apparently, like, he really set the standard for that stuff. And it was really – and that's something that I learned after watching this. But looking back at the focus group testing when they watched video footage of Henry Lee talking, and they, like, weren't buying it just because he had a heavy accent.
That's crazy because it's not even like – like, he was easy to understand.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I guess these are, like, North Carolina, you know, just, like, average.
I mean, I guess so. And he was explaining really, like, difficult concepts but in layman's terms. Like, that even you and I could understand.
Like, I had never heard the term cast-off pattern.
Yeah.
And there's the part where he is in the staircase and he's explaining, like, oh, if it is a beating death, that when the instrument is brought up, you know, you will see blood spatter on the ceiling and the walls and everything. And they didn't find any of that. And that was one of the earliest things where I was like, oh, man, yeah, that's weird.
Right.
But yeah, they present him to that focus group and they're just like, we can't understand him.
Yeah. One really weird aside that I just want to point out is apparently they're living in this house for long after, like, the murder takes place, and they're just, I guess, not going by that staircase. But can you imagine that?
Well, I kept wondering if it was, like, the brother's house. Like, Michael Peterson has a brother that we see a lot. Because I was trying to, I don't know the exact layout of the house, but I was thinking, like, there's no way they're just staying in this place.
Apparently
that still
are.
Has the blood on the staircase.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was the same house. I guess, I don't know for sure, but, like, I thought that it was someone else's house. Because that would be
so.
Really weird.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, but I'm pretty sure it is the same house. But anyway, proceed with the main beats of the story.
So another thing we see a whole lot of in this is Mike Peterson's family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complicated situation with all the children because he has been married before. He has brought on children from close friends in Germany who, you know, the parents died. And so he adopted Martha and Margaret.
So he had two kids with his first wife, Patty, and that's Clayton and Todd.
Yes. And we meet Patty, who is a... seems like an intelligent robot.
She talks with precision.
Yes. Yes.
And then their close friend, Elizabeth Ratcliffe, she dies. And we'll get into that in a little bit.
Yes.
But then after that, Michael adopts her two children, Margaret and Martha.
Yes. So Martha and Margaret are the two kids we see the most of in this. And they mm-hmm. are very firmly in their father's camp.
Yeah. To the point where it's like, all right, you girls are in denial about some stuff here.
Yeah, there are some times where they don't really accept any anything. Like, there's not even, like, any moments of, like, this is weird.
There's, you know, one moment in specifically that I want to talk about once we get to it, but there's just a lot of things, like, a lot of red flags for me. Like, I get loving your father, and, like, I feel like I love you to death. Even if you killed someone, and it was pretty obvious that you killed that person, I could still love you. That doesn't mean I won't love you. It just means, like, well... shit's fucked up and, you know, we probably can't be together anymore, but I'm still gonna love you even if you kill someone, unless you kill someone in my family. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
Join us for next week on Panning the Stream.
Yeah. we've got the kids. We got two sons, which they are kind of around for this whole documentary. They don't really have a lot to say. They're on their father's side.
Yeah.
But yeah, not... are they biological of Kathleen and Michael?
No, I don't think Kathleen and Michael have any biological.
They're from
children.
Patty.
Yeah.
Well, okay, there is that one other daughter, too, though, that mm-hmm. is, I think that's Kathleen's daughter, isn't
Kathleen's
it?
Kathleen's daughter, yeah, but I don't
from
think
from a
it's
previous
Mike,
thing.
I don't think it's Michael's daughter. Yeah.
That's right, because she is the one kid that is actively against
right.
Michael. Mm-hmm. So you've got four kids from a variety of circumstances that are all firmly on Michael's side,
mm-hmm.
and then you have Kathleen's daughter that is very much against Michael. And so, yeah, we mentioned Elizabeth Ratliff before, and... okay, so it's a weird situation. Michael was a military guy, and for a while he was in Germany, and they had these neighbors, the Ratliffs, that were close friends. And, yeah, again, Martha and Margaret are Elizabeth Ratliff's daughters.
And at this point, they're just infants or tots. Very
yes,
young.
Very, very young. And what happens is one night she falls down, or, you know, she is found dead at the bottom of a staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is something that happened in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some weirdness about it being brought up in this trial that, like they exhume her body
right.
to find out, like, you know, oh, okay, was this a fall? Was this a brain hemorrhage?
Because at the time they said it was a brain hemorrhage, and that's what the initial autopsy said. But now the prosecution exhumes her body to see if maybe, and apparently it was embalmed, so it's in good condition, to see if there are any indications that it was more than a brain hemorrhage or something like that. But important detail to note is that Michael was the last person to see her alive.
Yes.
And go ahead.
Oh, and we have a lot of different reports from the scene of, like, you know, the police report says there wasn't a lot of blood.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are, like, numerous people that came to the house and
right.
said, like, oh, there was blood everywhere.
Right, yeah. There was a lot of people that – it seems like there was a lot of people at the crime scene before the police even got there, because I assume maybe they thought, like, oh, there's no way he killed her. They thought it was, like, a brain thing. And apparently she had been having severe headaches in the weeks leading up to it.
Yeah.
So, consequently, I guess with it in mind that it was just a medical accident and not, like, murder, they all banded together and cleaned up a lot of the blood. So when the police arrived, there wasn't a lot of blood.
Right. And I understand why this is a fishy thing, and obviously a crazy coincidence, if it is, you know, obviously if it is a coincidence, of both these women dying at the bottom of the stairs. But the things that made me wonder about this and wonder about Michael's innocence, specifically in this Germany
mm-hmm.
case, is they say that, like, the cops, you know, they held up, like, a bag of spinal fluid, and it had blood in it,
mm-hmm.
which would indicate that maybe she had a brain hemorrhage and, you know, that's what caused her to fall down the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is that, yeah, for weeks prior, she'd been complaining about severe headaches.
Right.
So, Yeah, we do have some evidence that she was having some issues. Yeah. And then if that is true about the, I believe it was an official police report that they found blood in her spinal fluid. Mm-hmm. That definitely would point towards, hey, maybe Michael was innocent here. But the prosecution, it sounds like we're trying to kind of plant the idea that like, oh, this gave him an idea of how to stage something.
Right. And I think it could be one of three things. I think either it's totally a coincidence that these two women that Michael Peterson were close to both died in a staircase. Or Michael Peterson saw that she died on a staircase and maybe took an idea from that and then killed Kathleen. Or he killed both the women.
Yeah. I mean, and this is not a Jinx type of miniseries. This is not one that has a very tidy, clear thing at the very end. Like, at the end of the Jinx, you know what happened. Right. I won't spoil it here. If you haven't seen the Jinx, it is one of the best pieces of television, period, I've ever seen. Not just a documentary. But, yeah, like, if this first one was an accident, it sounds like that could also cause a ton of blood. Because that's one of the things that makes you wonder at the very beginning, or makes you think that he had to be guilty. Because, like, oh, fall down the stairs wouldn't have this much blood. But then, you know, they do enough things where it's like, okay, what if she fell back this way and hit her head here? And then she slipped on the blood because they found blood on the bottom of her feet. So what if she slipped and fell back and hit it again?
Mm-hmm. Like, here's the thing, Dan. It's a big red flag for me. Michael Peterson's lawyer, we saw him. He was on camera when he found this information out, and it wasn't from Michael Peterson. If this was just a coincidence, I feel like Michael Peterson should have immediately told his lawyer, look, David, this is going to sound really weird, and it's just a huge coincidence, but one of my best friends in Germany 15 years ago died at the bottom of a staircase too. Yeah. Like, that should have been one of the first things he tells
him. Yeah, just to let him know, like, hey, this is gonna come up. Right. Like, there's no way this is gonna go under the radar.
Yeah. I mean, whether or not it should have been brought into the trial as evidence is another story. I disagree with the fact that it was brought in. I think that's, you know, prejudice is the jury, obviously, unfairly.
Right.
But I think in a larger picture, I think it's pretty incriminating. And when the prosecution exhumed the body, there was evidence that she had been beaten just like Kathleen had been beaten.
Right, because they exhumed the body and they do rule it as a homicide. They change the cause of death. So, yeah.
And that's, you know, there's a lot of controversy surrounding the Deaver guy who was the prosecution's blood spatter analyst. But that guy aside, just the medical examiner, I think Dr. Radish was her name, she said pretty blatantly, like, look, this is a homicide. Like, she used really aggressive language in the autopsy report that the defense takes issue with.
Right.
But, like, I don't see why she would make it up. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, you would think, too, that you mentioned Deaver, and you would think that, you know, why would he do it? But it turned out he worked for the SBI, right? And so this will come up later, but just to bring it up now because we're talking about blood spatter, he has a lot of the most damning evidence and testimony that kind of helped lead to the verdict here. Mm-hmm. And he is very much like, yeah, this is a homicide. We were able to recreate it. Like, it's lots of the footage of him trying to, like, you know, hit a sponge covered in red paint in a certain way to recreate the way the blood splattered, like, on his shorts
and things
like that.
The DNA analyst guy said it the best when he said essentially that Deaver had an outcome that he wanted, and he was just doing all these experiments to try to get to that outcome.
Yeah, regardless of how, like, realistic it was or whatever. He was just trying to see, like, we see footage of them trying to get blood on, like, the inside of these shorts. And, like, I think the woman is wearing the shorts while she's hitting the sponge or whatever. And they finally notice they get the red up the shorts and they're, like, celebrating. Like, oh, we did it. It's possible. Yeah. Like, and apparently that's not how you do things because they bring people in later that are just like, oh, no actual professional would do it this way.
Anyway, a big part of the case against Michael Peterson is they argue that his bisexuality was a catalyst for the murder. And they bring in a male escort, Brad, who he had been communicating with via email and obviously seemed like they wanted to get it on with each other.
It's quite clear in the language they use that they wanted to get some business going on.
But ultimately, they never got it on. They never met. But Michael Peterson himself admits that he had had numerous affairs. Well, does he even call them affairs? I think he's, like, reluctant to call them affairs, right?
I mean, he admits that he's slept with, like, several different men, but no women. But the thing that gets me is that he says numerous times throughout this that, like, Kathleen knew the situation. She knew that he was bisexual. She knew he was kind of sleeping around and stuff. But outside of his words, there's not really a lot of evidence that
there's
she
no
did
evidence,
know that.
But even his words are damning because sometimes he says she knew. Other times he said, oh, it was, like, an unspoken thing and she just accepted it. And then, like, later on in one of the later episodes, he talks about her not knowing. Like, it's – I just think – honestly, I kind of believe the prosecution that this was the catalyst for her being murdered. And also, apparently, beyond the documentary and just some research I did afterward, apparently there was a lot of financial issues, too.
Oh, okay.
But just specifically the bisexuality thing. Especially, like, you know, we get to know Kathleen's sisters throughout this documentary. And I understand that they're pretty convinced that Michael killed their sister. And anyway, aside from that, they kind of show themselves to be maybe closed-minded, like
very old-fashioned very in their views on, you know, like definitely marriage, and like would not be open to the idea of like a marriage, you know, having like any kind of openness or poly stuff or bisexuality.
I mean, openness, bisexuality aside, like just the very idea of having an open marriage is a lot to stomach for a lot of people. I think even me, like it would be a lot to stomach, you know, if you just came to me and was like, "Hey, Bianca, not only am I bisexual, but I'm going to start sleeping with other guys."
You don't have to worry about that, honey.
And apparently he had like really damning internet history, you know, emails with these people, photos of hardcore gay sex and stuff, things that would suggest that, you know, he's maybe interested in other guys or interested in finding stuff outside the marriage. So I could understand if she was upset upon finding that.
Yeah. And it's just, it runs the gamut of him saying that like, "Oh, this was a direct agreement we had, right, and she knew exactly what I was doing," to like, yeah, like you said, kind of a suggested thing. Like, oh, she would kind of joke with me at like military bases.
Yeah, joking and like having a frank discussion about something are two very different things.
Yeah, when it comes to something like this, it's like, okay, does your wife know you are sleeping with other people?
Yeah.
Because that is the prosecution's thing, is like, okay, she probably found some emails, she probably found some evidence, you know, maybe emails to the prostitute or whatever, and then like confronted him with it, and in a fit of rage or whatever, he freaked out and beat her to death.
Right.
So that is a big part of the prosecution's angle. And it is fishy the way Michael kind of shifts the way he talks about that throughout the whole thing.
Right.
And again, like no real evidence that they did have any kind of agreement, you know, no.
And even the kids, like the kids know about the bisexuality, but after the murder, they learn about it. Because I assume, or if I'm recalling correctly, they kind of knew it was going to come up in trial, and they talked about it before the trial started. But even the kids didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It just seems very fishy. And but anyway, that's another significant component of the prosecution's case.
Yeah, and I'd say the two big things the prosecution leans on are the bisexual angle and also the blowpoke. And it's a thing at the very end of the trial, the defense finds the blowpoke. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird because, like, you do see the defense being like, "Is this weird to bring up this late? Like, it seems like they found it legit, but it's like, oh, I don't know. Could one of the sons have, like, you know, thought he was helping?"
And the fact that Clayton found it, I think you could tell, kind of concerned some people. Because something the documentary doesn't address, but Clayton had a criminal history.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe they didn't want to bring him on the stand because, you know, they would think he would be, like, you know, not a reliable witness.
I didn't realize that.
But he had done bombings at a college campus. Yeah.
Holy shit.
In 1994, he was 19 at the time, and he attempted to firebomb Duke University.
Oh, my God. What was the motive?
I think he wanted to, like, distract people and then go steal some stuff.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so stuff like that. And apparently that wasn't the only incident with, like, him doing terrorist kind of stuff.
Crazy.
And that's something the defense doesn't talk about, or the documentary doesn't talk about.
Yeah, and I mean, I could see how if you're a juror, you can think, well, okay, if somebody is willing to plant a bomb at a university, like, and the idea of hiding a blowpoke isn't a big stretch.
Yeah, yeah. But so apparently the blowpoke, they do tests on it, and it seems like it was there for a while.
Yeah, lots of, you know, bugs and dust and cobwebs and stuff that would indicate that, like, okay, it's been there longer than before the murder.
Right. And later we find out that it had been found, like, during the initial police search. And they took a photo of it, but apparently it got lost in the shuffle, and then they just assumed that that was that he hid it and that was the weapon. So that's just incompetence.
Stuff like that. There's a lot of things in this that, you know, it kind of shakes my confidence. And I'm somebody who likes to think that things just work the way they should.
Right.
Where it's like, oh, bad guys get punished for doing bad things and good guys don't go to jail and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's not how it
works. And yeah, like when I see this stuff, that's just like incontrovertible evidence that like, you know, these police officers and blood splatter analysis are like very actively manipulating evidence or purposefully ignoring stuff that doesn't fit their narrative and everything. Mm-hmm. It's it kind of shakes your confidence in the system for sure.
Yeah, and like think of it this way too. We are watching this documentary and very focused on this one specific case. But for the prosecution, this isn't their only case. They're dealing with a ton of cases. And why would they put like special efforts into one case when, you know, and it goes through so many people, right? It's not like it's one person gathering all the evidence, but it you have to have like seamless communication between everyone in order to, you know, have a fair trial. And especially in a world where it's really easy for them to omit things. But from what I understand, I think the prosecution is obligated to share any incriminating evidence with the defense, so that, you know, they could have a refute it in some way. But it's really scary, really sad, and you know, it happens all the time where people are framed. You know, people, they just don't care if someone's like a low income person, and what are they going to do? You know, if it's just easier for them to be like, okay, we solved this case. And then, you know, ruin someone's life. I mean, you are taking part of their life away. When you take even just a year or two, you know, it's ludicrous that these guys, like the one guy that was in this documentary, Glenn Taylor, I think.
The guy that was the Innocence Project, got him out. Yeah,
18 years or something. His whole kid's, like, life until adulthood. It's crazy.
That part was crushing to me when he's just in his home talking about how, like, oh, I miss my daughter's. Mm-hmm. Like, I met this person after I got out of jail, and, like, I don't know you. I don't know how you got to be this person. Like, that was so crushing to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's wild to think about, and really scary to think about, that the fact that there are probably like thousands of people in prison right now that did not do what they're in prison for. And it's like such a helpless feeling.
It's incredibly difficult to even think about. And I just can't imagine what it's like for those people and their families. And it's just, like, you even look at Michael's kids here, and like, they are 100% convinced that he is innocent. Mm-hmm. And so for them, in their minds at least, they are the families of an innocent man, and they're watching the system put their father away, which I guess that's a good way to just get right to the verdict here.
Right.
So after the blowpoke thing and everything, I kind of thought that it was going to be a not guilty verdict.
So did I.
And
or like a hung jury or something.
Yeah. But sure enough, 2003, the verdict comes in guilty. Mm-hmm. He's sentenced to prison.
Which is insane, because I think Michael Peterson's guilty, but there was so much evidence there for there to be reasonable doubt. Like, it blows my mind that the jurors did that. It really, like, makes you lose faith in humanity in a way, because they're the people that, you know, other people's lives are hanging in the balance of, you know, hanging in their hands. You know what I mean? It's
gotta be so, like, I imagine if I was, you know, on trial for something I didn't do, and I just look over and see 12 people that I've never met and I don't know anything about. And it's just like, well, okay, I guess I just sit here and don't say anything and just hope things, you know, go the right way and they don't get the bad opinion of me or whatever and put me away for the rest of my life. Like,
oh, you'd be in for the rest of your life. I guarantee. You think so? One look at you.
What am I charged with?
Capital murder.
Christ.
Yeah.
I've never even been in a fight.
Oh yeah, capital murder, my friend.
I am a prime example of when people talk about video game violence and stuff, you know, turning kids violent. Mm-hmm. I was raised on a steady diet of Mortal Kombat and the most violent goddamn R-rated action movies in the world. Mm-hmm. I love seeing that stuff fictionally, but I can't stand any of that. Like, I you know me, I'm squeamish about, like, I can't see pictures of that stuff.
Yeah.
I, you know, like, real life violence just is, I mean, as I think it should be for anyone, is abhorrent.
Yeah, I also grew up on a steady diet of gore, and I am not averse to, like, crime scenes and, like, you know, I've seen some really bad car crashes and stuff. If for some reason it's surgery that gets me. I can't really watch. Huh. I can't watch a surgery. But
see, that's more okay with me, because that's in, like, a safe medical environment that's meant to happen. You
it's
know,
just it's a weird hang up of mine. But the only, and I have no violent compulsions whatsoever.
No.
And like, when I was a kid, played fucking Soldier of, I would mainline Soldier of Fortune for hours.
Yeah,
it just like
chopping,
blowing
up the
off people's heads in like particular ways. But the only compulsion of violence I ever had was when I was a young kid, and I've told you this story before.
Oh, yeah.
My brother Tom pelted a Guinness Book of World Records at my head, and I just ran up to him and smacked him in the head with a telephone, and then locked myself in the bathroom because I was afraid he would retaliate. But that was the only thing I've ever done that was violent.
Well, I look forward to the trial and ensuing documentary on that case. You know,
the telephone.
Bring to light 20 years later. Yeah. Yeah, the telephone starring Bunk. So yeah, he's in jail for a long time, and we get a couple little updates here. The filmmakers are still interested in this case. They visit him a couple points in prison, but then in 2011, the stuff about Deaver and the blood spatter and all that stuff, it kind of comes to light. He gets in trouble for some other stuff, and they release him on bail, $300,000 bail and an ankle bracelet.
Yeah, the short version is the Deaver guy lied about a lot of stuff and put away people that shouldn't have been put away. And then they applied for a retrial? I don't know.
They an appeal or
yeah,
something.
Okay, yeah, they did an appeal. And then he was able to get out on bail and await a retrial or a dismissal of the charges.
Yeah, and, you know, it does not lead to a big dramatic second trial or anything. What it leads to is this kind of bittersweet thing. Like, I guess it's bittersweet if you believe in his innocence or if you're his family. Mm-hmm. But he does get released on an Alford plea, which mm-hmm. I never heard of before. This is in 2017. Where basically you're saying, like, yeah, I kind of did it. It's very loosey-goosey.
Well,
the way it's...
the Alford plea is like saying, you're essentially saying you're admitting your guilt. But the way they tried to frame it was like, listen, I'm not guilty, but I understand there's enough evidence here to convict me. But one of the moments I was talking about earlier with the daughters, just a weird moment was, and I don't know if you remember this, Dan, but like Michael Peterson was sitting on the couch with, I think, like Clayton and Margaret and Martha, and he was asking them what he should do. Should he go for the retrial or should he take this plea?
Right.
And you could kind of tell that he wanted them to say take the plea because he just wanted it to be over with, and he didn't want to go through another trial because, you know, another trial would probably convict him.
And he's getting older. At this point, he's in his like early 70s.
Oh, yeah, he's getting older. And, you know, another trial means the possibility of coming back guilty. And the girls are like, oh, no, you should do the trial. Like, they say that. And you could tell that's not really the answer he wants. And then Clayton says, like, oh, you should do the plea. But
yeah, like, what do you win by, you know, like, right. Why don't you just get out and enjoy the rest of your life?
And... right. And, like, yeah, you could just tell, like, he knows, like, if it goes to trial again, he's probably done for it. But there are certain things in the later episodes that further cemented in my mind that he was guilty. And one of the things that the defense doesn't talk about at all, and the documentarians admit from the show, is the strangulation evidence. Apparently there was evidence of strangulation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I know Candace, when she was like doing her whole spiel at the, I guess, the retrial hearing.
Right, the sister that's just really laying into Michael.
She talks about the strangulation evidence. And I thought about it. I was like, I don't remember them saying anything about that.
No.
But apparently there was a lot of strangulation evidence, or evidence that she had been strangled. And furthermore, like, there was, like, just so much stuff that the documentary left out. Like, there was apparently a footprint on the back of Kathleen's body, like a bloody footprint that was the shoes that Michael Peterson was wearing. You know, the blood in his pants, which they did talk about, but apparently was pretty damning.
I feel like there was, like, passing mentions of a bloody footprint, but, like, definitely nothing that they, like, lingered on. That, like, if that was a piece of evidence, that is worth lingering on for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently, too, the whole family was in debt, so they would have that to gain from her death. But I don't think it was premeditated, but that's something right. they could have gained.
Yeah, it's when watching something like this, you always have to be very cognizant of, you know, the power of editing and everything. And I think everyone, if you ask them, you know, will admit, like, oh yeah, obviously you can make anything look like anything through editing or whatever. But like, it really is true how effective mm-hmm. good editing can be.
Sure.
And if these filmmakers came in believing that Michael was innocent and wanting to show that he was innocent, it's very easy to just, hey, we mm-hmm. won't show that thing. Oh, we got this here. We got this, right. you know, interview footage, but no, we don't need to show that. And it can really powerfully sway the way you view something.
So I just want to share this comment from someone on Reddit who's from the Durham area where this took place. He says he was caught lying about his war record and medals when he ran for mayor and lost the election. He used to write newspaper columns that were very condescending, and he was known for being a windbag and lecturer who loved to hear his own voice. He was out of work for years, and his wife was working for a failing company and likely going to be laid off shortly. And practically all of their net wealth was the equity in their mansion and not actual liquid wealth. So no one in Durham thinks he's innocent.
Yeah, don't they touch on him lying about some of the war stuff?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. And I mean, you kind of do get that sense. Like, you hear him talk about himself a lot mm-hmm. in this movie, in this documentary, and that all checks out with me. Mm-hmm. Like, he does seem like kind of somebody who can really, like, weave a yarn,
yeah,
tell
a tale. And the way he talks, too, is just, like, he has this way of speaking where he will, whenever he's talking about his guilt or innocence, he always, like, has a jokey way of saying it.
Yeah, like laughing and stuff.
Yeah,
and
I feel like if I was on trial for something I didn't do, I would be deadly serious about it.
Yeah.
But one theory that I think is worth mentioning real quick is the owl theory.
Yes.
So it's a lot of people think that it wasn't a fall or murder that killed Kathleen, but instead it was an owl. Because apparently these very large owls are common to the Durham area.
Is it raptor owls? Is that what they're called?
I don't know the species, but apparently it's not uncommon for these owls to attack people and for the attack to feel similar to like a baseball bat hitting your head. Like really.
Jesus.
Yeah, because they're huge. And her head wounds were consistent with the talons of the owl. Apparently, she had owl feathers in her hand, along with her own hair. So that theory suggests that, like, she was trying to pull away the owl and got some feathers in her hair or in her hand along with her own hair.
God, I just feel like there would have to be like an extraordinary amount of evidence for this. Like, especially like, well, if she was attacked outside, wouldn't there be like massive amounts of blood leading into the house? Or like, is the theory that the owl was in the house somehow anyway?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then attacked her and then flew out? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a really crazy thing and interesting to think about for sure, but like that seems less plausible than everything else presented as possible outcomes.
Yeah, and I would recommend watching the Forensic Files episode about this case because apparently it shows how biased this documentary is.
Oh, really?
It shows like the full spectrum of evidence and everything.
Oh, okay.
So that might be worth checking out if the listeners want a more whole view of what actually happened. But yeah, I think he's guilty. I think it's pretty obvious that he's guilty, although there is, you know, the defense made a case for there being doubt, you know what I mean? But I think he is a weird guy who killed his wife and his friend.
Elizabeth Ratliff, too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I swung around. I think you stayed pretty much the course to him being guilty the entire time, mm-hmm. as we talked a little bit in between episodes. And I thought at the beginning, oh, of course, he's guilty. Like, look at this. Like, there's no fucking way she fell down the stairs. To, like, as the documentary kind of got in the middle, like, really mm-hmm. got into the meat of it, that I was really starting to wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end, just kind of, yeah, like, talking to you and kind of looking at the evidence and everything and being like, yeah, there's enough here that's a little bit hinky that I think he's probably guilty.
His inconsistency, his attitude, the circumstances of the murder, the fact that another woman also died in similar circumstances. Yeah. You know, he keeps changing his story about not only what happened, but about whether or not she knew about the bisexuality. Like, and apparently he's lied in the past. So I think personally that there's no doubt that he killed her. That being said, if I was on the jury the first time around, I would have said not guilty.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on all points there.
Yeah.
Like, I think it should have been a not guilty verdict, but like, I do think everything points towards him being the culprit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, overall, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a fun adventure. And I feel like we learned a lot more about how that process works.
Yeah, in being longer, I think you just inherently see so much more of how that stuff works.
Right.
You know, because like, we love stuff like, you know, the 5-part OJ one that ESPN did. It's like, that's a lot of like, you know, seeing what was on TV and the trial itself. But
that
this
was more about like the circumstances around, like the culture, like what was going on in society at that time, and like, you know, the racial issues around it. More than the actual trial, and this was really a focus on the trial.
Yeah, and just seeing the conversations between the lawyers and the family and the defendant and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's a very interesting deep dive on that process.
So what's next week, Dan?
Next up will be nothing like this. We have hopped from anime to real-life murder to Undercover Boss.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a couple episodes here. They're going to be a bit different. You might want to, if you want to watch with us, bring out a pen and paper right now, because it's a little funky the way we're going to do it. One of them is one we wanted to watch for a couple weeks now. It's a new one. It is Undercover Boss Celebrity Edition, Season 9, Episode 6,
mm-hmm.
which is the Stephanie McMahon episode. So we heard about this. You know, I've never seen Undercover Boss or anything, but I heard Stephanie McMahon was on there. We saw the pictures and thought, oh, that's just Stephanie McMahon in a blonde wig. How could anybody ever fall for that? So we will see. Like, I kind of have my suspicions that this is just like a, oh, feel good. Let's work with the brand. And we're going to, like, they're not going to, like, uncover any, like, serious shit on fucking CBS's Undercover Boss or whatever. So, like, I'm just kind of curious how this all plays out. So, yes, the Celebrity Edition of Undercover Boss, Stephanie McMahon, Season 9, Episode 6. And I have found that on CBS All Access,
mm-hmm.
A fine CBS property.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you will be able to watch that for free. I checked on the site beforehand, and it looks like you can watch that episode for free. And then we are going to watch an episode of Vanilla Undercover Boss.
Yes.
No celebrities involved. This is going to be the Checkers fast food. I feel like I've seen some of these before, but I've never been to one.
Right, and apparently in this, the consequence was...
Well,
the place actually shut down, right? Is that why you...
Yeah, I saw a headline. Like, I just Googled, like, oh, best Undercover Boss episode.
Right.
And it sounds like this one has some big consequences. I don't know the details of it.
So that's why I'm just... This is all just to say why we plucked that one out of the...
Yeah. It's not random. So this one you can find on Netflix. And this is Season 3, Episode 4. And it should have Checkers in the title. So one more time, CBS All Access, Season 9, Episode 6 of Undercover Boss Celebrity Edition with Stephanie McMahon. And on Netflix for Undercover Boss, the Checkers episode, Season 3, Episode 4.
And,
sorry for the mouthful. And?
And
what?
The 1997.
Oh. Bianca, she wants... No, we're not. I'm not going to say it because
okay,
then
all right, don't,
people are
going
to be disappointed when we
say.
Don't do it. Fine. Maybe sometime it'll get its own episode.
All right,
but
fine.
We have to talk about whether it's... First of all, it's not even streaming anywhere.
Yeah,
that's
but...
the whole... That's the title of the podcast.
That's valid.
It's about a stream.
I'm
that's
sure
a
it's on Vimeo somewhere.
And we haven't done movies before either.
Okay, all
so
right, that's fair.
We'll see. Maybe we'll cross that bridge at some point. But for now, we're going to stay somewhat true to the original, the vision that we had here on Panning the Stream. So yes, check out that Undercover Boss business that I talked about for next week. And as always, I want to thank Tom Manda for the theme song.
That's my brother.
Yeah, that is your brother of Thank You Scientist. Mm-hmm. If you would like to send suggestions, which we've been getting some anime suggestions at panningthestream@gmail.com. You can also send feedback or anything to Pan the Stream on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And if you can go to iTunes and give us the whole like little 5-star review and write a little nice thing, that'd be great. Also, we're newly on Spotify, so that's got to be one of the easiest ways to find us. If you don't have a dedicated podcast app, feel free to search for Panning the Stream on Spotify and join us next week for Undercover Boss. Bonk, thanks for joining me.
Oh, pleasure. My pleasure.
Bye, folks.
Just pleasure.
Bye-bye.